1290. Stay tuned.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel, and Diane Duva and I are your hosts every week, right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11 and Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
How are you doing today, Neil?
I am glad to be home.
Yes, you're back from the evacuation.
From my third evacuation.
Fortunately, we didn't suffer any damage, which was great.
And I hope that the fact that we had a six tenths of an inch per hour rainfall and nothing happened is a good omen.
Yes, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. I like evacuating as much as the next guy, but I've had enough.
You've had enough of the evacuation.
Yeah, I've also had enough of these articles because the beginning article is driving me nuts, and that is the Trump's tariff plan. And this is not a surprise that we have an article today about the tariffs. Oh, by the way, we have a guest today too. I almost forgot.
We have partner of Ambrick and McDermott, Brooke McDermott, in studio with us. Thanks for being here today, Brooke.
Hi, thank you both for having me.
So we're going to talk about something less emotional. We're going to talk about estate law in a minute, but right now we're going to talk about tariffs. And the announcement that Trump made apparently off the cuff last week that he's going to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum has set off quite a discussion of the
discussion. I think it's been a market event as well. Yeah. The market did not like the news that he shared.
Well, the market did go up today, I think, because of some talk that if they renegotiate NAFTA, maybe he would back off. But whatever, there are so many things that the tariff, the idea of a trade war and deploying tariffs as a way of helping America is so against the historical record. In fact, many scholars believe that the Depression was a result of the Smoot-Hawley legislation, which was protectionism back in 1930s that created the atmosphere for a trade war, which people think did more damage than anything else. But getting back to this tariff, the idea that we should charge people who are countries that are manufacturing steel and aluminum. First of all, the reason that, for example, aluminum is made in Canada more than in America is because one of the most significant costs in making aluminum is power, and power is significantly cheaper in Canada. So first of all, it makes sense that Canada is a producer of aluminum. Second of all, if you look at the number of jobs in these industries, and the article I have here is from the New York Times, but there's a similar article in the New York in the Wall Street Journal. If you look at the number of people in those industries, they employ fewer than 200,000 people. But companies that use steel and aluminum to make everything from trucks to chicken coops employ 6.5 million workers. So you're trying to fix something, if you can, for 200,000 people, and it possibly going to affect 6.5 million people. The second thing is that trade wars typically end up with damage to everybody. And one of the things that is sort of expected is the EU announced this morning that while they think it's crazy that they're about to announce this, they have no choice, but if Trump goes ahead with this, they're going to put in their own tariffs on bourbon, because 80% of all bourbon in the world is made in Kentucky, and they want to hurt the Senate Majority Leader. And Harley-Davidson, because I think it's made in Indiana or in Ohio. So they're going to pick specific industries that will have political effect on people who have the ability to make a decision on these tariffs. And the last thing is that, you know, Trump has said that infrastructure is so important, and everyone kind of agrees that infrastructure is so important, but infrastructure requires steel. So the cost of doing an infrastructure for this country that has literally billions of dollars of infrastructure needs and raising the cost of steel to do that is really self-destructive. And as a result, if it in fact does take place, besides a disruption in the industry, you're going to end up with inflation. And if inflation because what you're doing is you're increasing the steel, which will increase the price of everything that steel or aluminum uses.
Right. And so, you know, it will hit everybody because, you know, in that article, it also talks about the beer manufacturers of Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors, and aluminum affects them.
I know. And you know, one of the things that I think hurts, you know, people who are trying to try and make a decision on the direction the country is going in with Trump is that he's making decisions off the cuff because Cohn, his chief economic advisor, has been a very strong advocate of not doing this. And apparently he was taken by surprise when the president announced this. So, forget your politics. I think there's no empirical evidence to prove that this is a good idea.
Although lots of people say that Trump does this type of thing to distract from the real issue at hand, which could be, you know, some form of gun reform after the Florida shooting.
Well, I hope so, because I think that this would be really, really silly to do. On a more cheerful note, there was an article in today's Wall Street Journal that I think, while it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, I think it is a good lesson. And it has a story about Sally Krawcheck, who is one of the top female executives in the financial industry.
I think is important that she's been fired twice. And she recently started her own women-only investment company. And so but the important part is that in this movement that we have right now of inequality with genders, and she's starting her own firm, and I think that she's a testament of what maybe, you know, surviving against all odds. But now go on with your tongue-in-cheekness of the article.
Well, hold on a second. Do you say she was fired because she was a woman? Are you trying to
any article that she's been interviewed in about the firing is that she was a scapegoat, and because she was a woman, they made her an easier target.
Well, what she says today, which I happen to agree with, is that the best investment she ever made was buying her summer house, where she made $7.5 million. The worst investment she ever made was buying stock in a company she worked at, Bank of America, where she lost $500,000. And I think that that's really interesting. And I don't know whether you believe in this as a financial planner, but when people are first investing, I can't think of a better investment than your house, because you get the utility of using it at the same time you get appreciation. And over the long term, housing has done just as well, if not better, than the stock market.
Well, actually, over the long term, if you look at the charts, it hasn't as an investment. But because you do use it, that's what makes it so valuable. And I think really the takeaway of this article is that you want to diversify. So you want to have real estate as well as liquid assets. Because unfortunately, if you need money, you can't live off of your house unless you have already signed up for a line of credit or some means. If you need cash, you can rent out rooms. I think real estate's a very viable way to create wealth for yourself. But it's important not to have it all in one asset class.
Well, but one of the advantages of real estate, besides the utility, is the fact that it's illiquid, and therefore
it prevents people from making the wrong decision at the wrong time. Absolutely,
which typically they do.
I will not argue that point with you.
And I think we have time for one more article, and that is titled "Consumers Ramp Up Debt." And it's not just debt. What I think is really distressful here is that this is non-housing-related debt, which is basically credit cards. And overall households, the article goes on to say, are paying about 5.8% of their disposable personal income to stay current on non-mortgage debts. And, you know, no matter what kind of credit card you've got, you know, maybe you got 12% interest or 26% interest, but it's really nutty to buy things on a credit card and keep the debt outstanding. And
absolutely. And the only time that it may make sense is if you have this teaser rate of a 0% type of arrangement with the credit card companies. And usually they only offer those if you don't need them. And so I've seen it work for some people to use it as a debt tool at a 0% financing rate. But most of those people have the cash to pay it off if something were to change on that interest rate.
And to show you how bad it is, in the fourth quarter, consumer debt, excluding mortgages, rose from 5.5% to $3.82 trillion, the highest amount since the Federal Reserve Bank began tracking this data.
Well, I think what's important to realize is that we're at historic lows in unemployment, and so our country is at full employment, one would say, and people are feeling comfortable. There's starting to be some wage pressure for the first time in 20 years of people are making more money. And so people are starting to feel comfortable and taking on debt that perhaps they shouldn't. And normally these are all signs that we're in the late cycle of it. We're in the late or, yeah, the end of an economic expansion.
I wasn't going to mention this, but since you just brought it up, in the beginning of the article, it quotes a 33-year-old car salesman from Great Falls, Montana, who said that he got an offer from Capital One Financial and Discover Card to offer him new credit cards. So he got it in the mail, and he also took out a $36,000 loan to buy himself a new Jeep Grand Cherokee, which is about as crazy as you can get.
Right. It's definitely not debt that you want to take on. Right. I often say when I'm looking at or creating people's balance sheet, you have short-term debt to long-term debt, or in other words, bad debt to good debt. So you can use your home mortgage with the tax deductibility, albeit less this year than last year, but you still have that tax deductibility. And with credit card debt, you really have nothing, no benefit for you.
Right. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. And speaking of mortgage bankers, based on the article about Sally Cruikshank, people should people should go out and buy a house and get a mortgage.
They should, and then they should give Kelly a call. She and her team do a great job at Cornerstone. So we have with us in studio Brooke McDermott, who's a partner at Ambrick and McDermott. And it's very nice to have you, Brooke. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And so, you know, let's start out with a little background about you and what drew you to law and, in particular, estate planning.
Sure. Yeah. I went to law school after graduating from UConn, University of Connecticut.
We were just talking at the break that we're all East Coasters in this room, or I should say formerly East Coasters.
Yeah, it's true. You can say UConn back to people from back East. People out here think you're saying Y-U-K-O-N, unless you mention basketball, and right. Then they're all on
then
board.
Then Huskies.
Yes, that's it. So, and I graduated with a degree in English and went on to go to Suffolk Law. And partly when I was there, I got interested in property law and just the whole idea of estate planning and everything that goes into it. I also had a personal incident where my uncle suddenly passed away. And I had cousins that were in their late teens, and my aunt, you know, was in her 40s, and they never really thought that this was going to come about. And I think the tailspin that it threw the family in, because there wasn't planning done, and they weren't sure where documents were, made me even more compelled to take a look at estate planning, and it was an interest for me. And I enjoy counseling people and helping people out. I like the friendly side of law, not the confrontational
right.
side.
You don't like the litigation part?
No. We don't do litigation at all. So, yeah, so it you know, I fell into estate planning very naturally and focused in it on it when I was at Suffolk Law School. And then liked it so much that went on to go and get my master's in law at University of Miami, specifically in estate planning.
And so tell us a little bit about that. What does that actually mean?
So an LLM, law school does things backwards. You get your doctorate first, you get a JD, and then you can go and get a master's, unlike most programs where you get a master's and then you get a doctorate. But what an LLM does for you is it just focuses your interest in a particular field of law that you think you want to go into. I mean, I think there was a day when people would come out of law school and they would be general practitioners and practice every kind of law, and you just kind of, you know.
And you see that more in rural settings where there aren't very many attorneys.
You totally do. You totally do. But I think nowadays everybody kind of picks a particular field so that you can be an expert in that area and know that particular field very well. And that's what I wanted to do. And I knew before jumping into estate planning, because it's basically a ton of tax law, that I was going to need just the extra boost that a master's in law would give me before.
And so it's an additional year of schooling, correct?
It's an additional year of school. Yep.
And now do you apply much like you would for any master's program?
You apply like you would for any master's program. So then cross your fingers, hope you get in, and it's just a year. And then I started practicing law out here in California.
So you went to schools that had, one has a great basketball team and one has a great football team.
That's it.
Is that the reasons
prime reasons, yes.
So you went from, you basically went from the Northeast down to Miami for your master's, and then what made you come out to California?
So I was aiming for nice weather. So that was priority number one.
So you made the mini step down to Florida.
So I made the mini step down to Florida.
And you're like, hurricanes, I'm out of here.
Yeah, hurricanes, humidity, you know, figured, no, I'll trade that for, you know, dryness, mudslides, and earthquakes.
So
I made the move out here because I had graduated from my LLM program in 2008, and that's when the subprime mortgage event hit in Miami first. And so there was not a lot of estate planning, not a lot of expansion in legal jobs that was going on in that area at the time. And there happened to be a wonderful firm out here in Santa Barbara, and I decided to join and come out and make the leap. faith to California. And it's, I've never regretted it since. Never looked back.
Well, you got the benefit of having to take the California bar.
That's right. Took the Florida bar and then, you know, came out here and said, hey, I want to trade up. Not do a 2-day bar. I'll do a 3-day bar instead.
Right. And maybe you should take the New York bar just so you can have the trifecta.
It's true. Of all the states that don't have reciprocity with one another.
Yeah. Just for excess. Just work. For free time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So now with the recent changes to the tax law, given that estate planning is so woven into the fabric of the tax law changes.
Yeah.
What do you see as if somebody out there is listening who has already created an estate plan for themselves, what are some of the major things that they should look out for with this new tax legislation that passed in January?
So my biggest thing that I say to everybody is take a look at your current estate plan. Review it. You should be reviewing it every 3 to 5 years with your attorney. But now when we've got this huge new tax law, the exemption went from $5.5 million to $11.2 million, basically, per person. So that means $22 million for a couple. And it could mean that some of the provisions that you have in your current trust or estate plan no longer accomplish the goals that you set out for them to accomplish when you had a much smaller exemption amount.
A great example is in 2000, when I started in this business, the exclusion was $675,000.
Yep.
So a lot of those trusts were built with bypass provisions for the kids upon the death of the first spouse to bypass having to pay taxes, estate taxes. Now, what happens if you are dealing with an old document such as that has that bypass provision in it, which is no longer necessary? Do you still have to follow it if it's in the document?
If it's in the document, you need to follow it. So that's kind of the kicker, because we out here in California do joint trusts. So typically, the plan that people had that's like a long-standing plan is you have a survivor's trust, and then you'll have a bypass trust and some type of marital trust. The survivor's trust represents the surviving spouse's one half of the community property and all of their separate property. The bypass trust and the marital trust get funded with the deceased spouse's one half of the community property and any separate property they have in the trust. And the marital trust and the bypass trust, the way that we figure out what amount goes into which trust, because it's not 50-50, is based on the tax law. So when the exemption was $675,000, $675,000 would go into the bypass trust, and the remaining amount would go into the marital trust. If you haven't taken a look at your plan and that three trust system hasn't changed, now we have an exemption of $11.2 million, which would mean that $11.2 million goes into a bypass trust and the remaining amount goes into the marital trust. There's so few people that are affected by an $11.2 million exemption. Like, they're not going to face paying estate taxes. So most likely what's going to happen is that marital trust never gets funded. The marital trust is set up so that all the income goes to your surviving spouse. And a lot of times they allow for invasion of principal. So you can access the principal as a surviving spouse in a marital trust. But bypass trusts are traditionally set up to take care of the deceased spouse's children. It also oftentimes includes the spouse. But there's more people that you can give income in principal to in a bypass trust. And with a lot of second marriages out there, that plan doesn't always work quite the way that everyone was envisioning it, and it certainly doesn't work the way it would have a few years ago.
Does this new tax plan have a sunset clause?
It does have a sunset clause.
So then what do you do if you decide to be cavalier and say, I don't need these trusts, and then for some reason 9 years from now the Congress doesn't renew it?
Yeah, so you roll the dice and decide, there's no way I'm going to die in the next 9 years. By January 1st, 2026, I'm still going to be kicking it. You know, I honestly...
But it reverts back to 5.5, right? Or 5.2, whatever.
It does. It reverts back. It's going to be probably around 6.2 if it reverts back to the old law, because it's still on an inflation trajectory. So all of those numbers are indexed for inflation.
But the real issue out there is I've seen people's trusts that... were written in the three trust system.
Yeah.
And they don't actually have a number designated, but they say the what happens if it says up to the limit of the exemption, basically. So you have an estate that might be $11 million, but they're now going to try to fund the bypass with $11 million and leave the surviving spouse without anything, really. How does that work?
Well, the surviving spouse would end up still with their half of the community property, but then, right, everything's going to go, the rest of it would go into a bypass trust, and you wouldn't need a marital trust at all. And sometimes that can put you in conflict with, particularly in a second marriage situation, where the surviving spouse and the children of the deceased spouse are both the income beneficiaries and the principal beneficiaries of a trust, and they're kind of at odds with one another because the surviving spouse wants to be able to use the funds, spend it, you know, keep
live
up with
lives,
their lifestyle.
Right,
exactly. The same lifestyle that they had before, which there's nothing wrong with that at all, except for the fact that you have additional beneficiaries in there too who also would like some, you know, assets from the trust.
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
Star Jasmine Music serves over 3,600 people per year. By providing a safe, supportive environment to explore music, you'll find a place that resonates within. We teach songwriting and how to play a variety of instruments. We have a Pro Tools state-of-the-art recording facility and provide opportunities for teens and young adults who show passion for music and demonstrate talent to record their work. This experience has been known to better one's self-esteem and often leads to development of skills in business and self-management. We have special programs for at-risk youth, as well as the mentally and physically challenged. When ready after a 10-week series, we record our students and give them a CD to show the fruit of their efforts. This experience leads to self-confidence. Visit us at www.starjasminemusic.org. Star Jasmine Music. Sharing music exploration through teaching and recording.
There are many sounds in your day-to-day life. There are sounds that wake you up. Sounds that make you smile. Sounds that energize you. And sounds that help you relax. But there are some sounds that can alert you to danger and can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you information about severe weather events, amber alerts, or other emergencies in your area. With critical information from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know, wherever you are. For more information, visit ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence. And we can be reached at 564-1290, and someone actually knew the number.
Exactly. So we have a caller. Hi, caller.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. How are you? Thanks for calling in. Do you have a question for us today?
I do. I was just curious how the new tax reform is going to change estate planning over the next couple of years.
Okay, great. So how do you foresee it changing estate planning and things you do, the new tax law?
I think one of the things that it's going to changes obviously involving taking a look at your current plan. That's my main thing, is going ahead and taking a look at your current plan, possibly considering some changes to it. The new plan keeps in place portability, which was in the law before.
So describe to us what portability actually means.
So portability is now the ability of one spouse to pass their exemption to the next spouse. And it's been there since the law changed in 2010. But with these exemptions now, the way that they are, that's $22 million for a married couple. So it's probably going to allow for a lot of people's plans to be very simplified and streamlined when the first spouse passes away, in particular when you have a longtime married couple that has, you know, same children from the marriage. It gets a little bit more complicated when you have a divorce situation, but...
And then a remarry.
And then a remarriage, and then additional children, right, and everything like that, yeah. But portability is here to stay, I would say. The complicated thing as an advisor with regards to the new tax law is that it does sunset on January 1, 2026. And it could possibly go away before then if we get a change in the administration and they make it a priority to do away with this so-called death tax planning. Because it really does only affect a very, very small segment of the population. Even before it was 11.2 million, when it was 5.5 million just last year, it was an infinitesimal amount of Americans were affected by it. So now you can kind of take a look at your planning and think about other things in addition to tax laws. It's not really the driving force on everything like it had been before when the exemption amounts were a lot smaller.
So on this show, we like to talk about businesses for people. Thank you, caller. We like to talk about businesses and the sort of way of succeeding in that business and some of the issues that affect the business. So looking at estate planning as a business, yeah, how does these changes affect the business? I mean, just take a cavalier view. Do I need an estate lawyer anymore? Is that going to hurt your business because people are going to think it's so simple I don't have to deal with it?
So my caution with anyone who thinks, oh, it's so simple, you know, they've got it all set now that it's pretty straightforward. We don't need to go through the exercise of having an estate plan in place of a trust or a will or a power of attorney, a more advanced healthcare directive. I would caution people from, you know, going that route or using something like a LegalZoom. I've just seen too many documents that get produced by something like that, and they're not – they don't do what people intend them to do. And I think, you know, when you're talking about your estate, when you're talking about assets passing on to family members, to your spouse, of making sure they're taken care of making sure that the health issues that you want addressed and the way that you want them addressed are accomplished, the best way to do that is to go and seek an advisor who knows what they're doing.
But, you know, if you look at the commercials on TV in the last 10 years for investment advisors, they tend to say, if you buy our service, you can do it yourself. You know that commercial with a guy sitting there with a knife saying, what am I supposed to do, put this knife in here and take my own appendix out?
Yeah.
And there's sort of been this sales pitch among certain brokerage firms that if you have enough information and enough good screens on your computer, you can do it yourself. And that has some effect. People stupidly have decided that they're as smart as the investment people. And I'm just wondering if that is going to be something that is going to come back, maybe not in Montecito or in Santa Barbara, but around the country in terms of estate planning.
I think, you know, it's definitely something that you need to consider and think about. And there's a lot of, you know, planning and ways that we can use technology to streamline the process. But I don't think it's a substitute for having an advisor sit there who's seen 100, you know, 1,000 different one of these plans and can sort of lead you in the right direction. Because my biggest issue when I have people come to see me is they go, I don't know what I want. I don't know what I need. I don't know how to address this. And so people are coming up with an answer to a problem that they, you know, have WebMD'd, so to speak, themselves. And so...
And we all know how WebMD MD
right. All of a sudden you have a rare disease or you have chicken pox.
Wait a minute.
You're not sure.
Are you saying I need to still go to a doctor?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Well, it depends. What did your wife say?
Yeah, no. I mean, you just, when you don't know the, you know, myriad of solutions that are out there and have an experienced individual who's sat through and gone through plans that have either blown up in people's faces or have succeeded, you know, triumphantly, you know, that's what happens when you've got someone experienced.
In my experience, what I see with my clients' plans is that they think it's going to, how they want it or how they've articulated it, how it's going to happen. And then when I read the document, how it's actually laid out in the document, they don't always see eye to eye with what they think it's going to happen and what the document says is going to happen. So I agree with you
that
people need to go in for a review every 3 to 5 years. And I have to say, the legal profession isn't so great at reminding them that they need to come in for a review every 3 to 5 years.
No, I would say not. I think we rely on people's advisors, like their financial advisors, their CPA, to sort of take a look and say, hey, you need to, you know, have something reviewed. I think people automatically figure that when something, you know, drastic has occurred in their family, either someone's died, someone's been married, children are born, that type of thing, they go, oh, I need to do something about my plan. And that's usually how estate planning goes. I feel like it's very reactionary. So there's a reason why we have an upspin in planning in November and December, because everyone's seeing their family.
Right after the holidays.
Right after the holidays.
So yeah, true. And we urge our clients to go get their plan reviewed when there are major changes. Yeah. And I can't tell you how often people don't go just because it's dealing with mortality, and no one likes to think of the inevitable of, you know, that they're going to die in some fashion. Yeah, and so it is hard to get them to go.
I wonder how many people after Christmas decide to take people out of their will after spending Christmas with them. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College is a nonprofit organization which supports our own Santa Barbara City College. The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College, or SBCC, funds scholarships, childcare, book grants, and other programs. Without these, many students simply would not be able to attend college. There is an amazing range of academic and vocational studies offered at City College which encourage students to find their passion and their talents. As a donor to the foundation, you have the power to change lives. Please help our community college by donating to the Foundation for SBCC. Call 730-4401 or visit us at sbccfoundation.org to find out how you can help. That's 730-4401 or sbccfoundation.org.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle, simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
I have bad news, Neil. I don't think our picture, Arlington Financial Advisors picture, is going back up on the wall at Arnaldi's. We're not having a good season. We switch days from Monday to Tuesday.
Wait a minute. They're going to take your picture, even though they sponsor our show, they're going to take your picture out of
it? Well, no. You only get your picture's only up if you're the champion. Then it gets swapped out to the next year's champion.
So there's no special compensation.
No special compensation.
Dispensation for this.
No favors.
Okay, sorry.
So Tuesday night league is good. I know. So if you're just joining us, we have in studio Brooke McDermott, who's a partner at Ambrick and Associate, or Ambrick and McDermott. Yes. So sorry. And so tell us, who is your typical client? What do you normally – who are the people that you normally work with?
So we usually work with clients that have some kind of a estate tax situation. So they're you know, going to be having an estate tax, and they need a plan around it. But with that said, we work with also a lot of family businesses as well that are trying to figure out how to successfully pass the business from one generation to the next. And either, you know, pass it off or sell it, really work with them on advising
on a succession plan. That's very important and
yeah.
and difficult. And so what types of documents do you put? Do you help the business owners come up with every step of the plan, or is it mostly the contracts, or what are you seeing?
Yeah, so we work with a lot of them on how, you know, coming up with the limited partnership agreements, coming up with you know, other estate tax strategies that can be used to try and minimize the transfer of the business, the value of it, when it does come around to estate taxes. But yeah, we do work with CPAs and their financial advisors on making sure that the whole deal is accomplished, and with their business attorney too, because we don't do a lot of the buy-sell agreements and things, but we're working on how that interpersonal transition of power from generation, first generation to the next generation occurs. Because a lot of times you've got people who are entrepreneurs. They are fantastic at what they do. They are brilliant. They came up with this amazing plan. And they have different talents in the next generation that need to be honed and used in the business. And how do we make that trade-off from the person who's used to running the business to the next generation stepping in and kind of coming to their, you know, their own being in the business.
Sounds like you might need a psychology degree as well.
I think with most estate planning, you do. You need you when they say counselor at law, it is truly the case when it comes to estate planning. There's so much that gets revealed in meetings with clients, and so much you find out about people's families, and you keep their confidences, and you make sure that what they reveal to you works with the plan that they have. And so it's becoming intimately familiar with a lot of aspects of your clients'
lives. And some of the most difficult family sagas take place third generation when there isn't planning. And and the cousins and the brothers and sisters never stop talking to each other and all hire lawyers. So it's not just an academic exercise. It's really important if you're the elder and you want your family to survive in one piece, it's really important to figure out how this transition will take place without everyone being mad at each other.
Yeah, our goal is to try to make sure that everyone doesn't lawyer up, so to speak, because what ends up happening is you just dissipate all the wealth that entrepreneur built by having infighting and not figuring out the plan ahead of time. So what we like to do is bring on that second generation while the first generation's still alive and kicking, and they're here and they can express their thoughts and their plans for the future, and the next generation can share where they think things are going, and we start to work together on transferring that power before mom and dad pass away. And I think it makes for you know, if people are comfortable with it, it's a lot of sharing about assets and the business. But I think it's a crucial step in making sure that it's successful, whether that be success in the form of transferring it to the second generation and the second generation running the business, or successful in terms of saying, you know what? No, we don't want to run the business. That is not where our passion lies at all. And so, hey, we need to come up with a strategy for selling it. But I think the success is not having a legal battle that everyone has to deal with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how do you counsel people who are embarking upon this plan of giving the business or selling the business to the next generation when everybody isn't on board? Where does that start? So let's say I'm a business owner.
Sure.
And I want to, it's my desire that my kids run my business. But my kids may or may not have any interest. How do you go about counseling those business owners to start talking about it and moving forward?
Yeah, so we usually start, you know, small. I think that everything needs to be kind of taken in little bites and pieces. And when you've got a business owner that's on board with transitioning it, it goes a lot smoother than someone that's resistant to the idea.
When the kids want the business and they want to kick mom or dad out.
Yeah. Which comes up too. I mean, they're sort of, you know, it's an emotional transition that's happening. It's the passing of the torch, and it's not an easy thing. Even if someone comes to you and says, okay, I'm all on board, I'm ready to do this. So I think it's a lot of working with mom and dad and saying, okay, well, what do you want to have happen? How does your family feel about this? And getting to know them really well, and then say, okay, let's start to bring the kids involved. Because, and I feel like a lot of times what it is it just opens up a discourse in a family, like much of the estate planning documents do, whether you have a business or not. I think it's an opportunity to have a conversation with your kids, and grandkids about what your thoughts are.
Well, and that is, I think, so important, because so all too often you have people that they don't want to share because we're raised in a society where speaking about money and assets isn't acceptable. And so the more you share with that next generation about whatever it is that you want, whether you want them to have the business or not, the easier things go, for sure.
I think definitely, because when people come into it prepared and not surprised once mom or dad passes away, it's a lot easier to handle the transition than if they come into a meeting with the estate planning attorney and they say, okay, so this is what mom and dad did. They wrote you out of the trust. You're not part of it. Everything's going to, you know, your other brother and sister. You know, that's not that's a horrible situation to have a family walk into. And it's, you know, a way of driving a wedge between everyone in the family. Whereas maybe mom and dad had a really good reason for, you know, leaving everything to brother one and brother two.
It doesn't matter if they had a good reason or not. If they didn't know about it ahead of time, it's not going to go over well.
That's it. So I think just opening up the discussion and things allows everyone to sort of, one, be prepared for what's going to happen, and to feel like they have a little bit of control over the situation too. So I find that when we've got families that know what the plan is ahead of time, they are comforted by it as well. Whether they're happy with it or not is a different story.
What if you're 35 years old?
Yeah.
You have two kids. You're kind of making ends meet. And the last thing you're thinking about is an estate plan.
Yeah.
Which I suspect is more common than not. How do you get these young people to get motivated to think about this? Like, you know, buying life insurance. No one wants to buy life insurance, but there are life insurance salesmen out there. There aren't estate planning salesmen. You know, lawyers typically don't sell.
No.
How do you get them to realize that you don't want to die without a will?
I mean, I think the thing is, like, you know, if you're 35, you're married, you have a couple of kids, you're just really trying to do the planning that's important for your spouse. And ultimately for your kids too. I mean, estate planning documents are a way to say, okay, who's going to be the guardians of my kids?
I have to say that's how I talk to my clients about it. Hey, you need to get a will set up at minimum.
Right.
Or else think about the person you don't want your children to be left with. That will be the person fighting tooth and nail to get your kids.
Right. And if you've done the smart thing and you've gone and gotten a life insurance policy, which for a younger individual, they're really inexpensive and they're a great way while the kids are young to hedge against anything happening to, you know, you or your spouse, you sort of go, okay, well, if something did happen to us and they're left with $1 million or $2 million life insurance policy, that's a different situation than if they're just left with nothing and they're going with your parents or one of your siblings. And money can be a driving force in a lot of people coming out of the woodwork. And that's where I think you want to make sure that somebody who you trust and you care about and has your values is taking care of the kids if something were to happen.
When I was younger, I think it was in my late 20s, I discovered that if 15 of my friends were to take a trip on a plane and they were, and the plane went down, I would have like 50 kids because everyone used the same names.
Yeah.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Hey, at our startup, my team and I move at the speed of tech 24/7. And every single day, it's information overload. It's coming at me from all directions. And you know what? Bottom line, I just need the news that matters. So where do I turn? Local radio and TV. I want to hear from people who live and work in my town. They give me the real story with information I know I can rely on. So where else can I find out what's happening in my community? Weather and traffic, things that affect my family and my business. I want to stay informed by sources I trust, my local radio and TV stations. For the best entertainment, sports, news, traffic, and weather, with no agenda and more reliable than other platforms. So if you ask me for the information I want anytime, anywhere, I stay local. Support your local station. Text radio to 52886 today. Furnished by the NAB and this station. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
Brooke, so as we enter into our last segment, let's talk a little bit about what would you recommend as a minimum estate plan for everybody? What should people have for sure in place?
Sure. So I definitely think at a minimum, there's four documents that everybody should have. They should have a trust, they should have a will, you should have an advanced healthcare directive, and you should have a durable power of attorney. So the durable power of attorney and the advanced healthcare directive are documents that are only in place while you're alive. And so once you pass away, those documents don't have any weight at all. And that's when your trust and your will kick in.
So those two documents, basically we're talking about how you want to end out your life, end of life care. So if I'm sick and intubated, do I want to stay alive for as long as possible in the hospital, or should my family pull the plug, right? That's the medical directive.
Yep.
And then the power of attorney is giving the person, somebody out there, you have the final say on what happens to me if I'm incapacitated in some way.
On finances. Yep, that's it exactly. So, and I think of the durable power of attorney as a backup document. So it is just there if you didn't transfer everything into your trust. But your trust is the main document that's dealing with how assets and finances are managed during your lifetime and then at death and afterwards.
So then let's define the difference between the will and the trust. And is there a threshold that you just need a will versus a trust, et cetera?
I think anybody that has a house and owns real property should have a trust. You can probably get by otherwise with a will, but a trust is always a good idea. The reason why I say that out here in California is if you just have a will, then you need to go through a probate. And probates have statutory fees based on the size of the assets. And then you can get extraordinary fees if it's above and beyond the complication. Maybe it's a complicated set of assets that you're dealing with. It's also public. I don't think there's a lot of people that want that much information about their finances and their personal lives and their plan being out in the world. And so I caution people about just using a will. I'd much rather have people use a will. We call it a pour over will. And basically what it says is I leave everything to the trustee of my trust. And so dump all the assets that I have that might be in my individual name that didn't make it into the trust, put them in the trust. And I want the trustee to administer everything. And that's what kind of plan you want to have.
Perfect. And I think that you did a really great job at describing that. So if someone's out there listening and they're thinking, gosh, you know, I have an estate plan, but I haven't, you know, it's sat on my shelf now for a decade or so.
Yeah.
How can they reach you? That's the best way.
They can reach us just by calling our office line. So it's 805-965-1329, or they can send me an email as well, too. You know, we're happy to help anybody. And if we're not the right fit, we're always happy to send referrals about, you know, another attorney that might be a good fit for people.
Well, thank you, Brooke. Not only very informative, but it wasn't depressing, which is why they should call you, because you're not going to hurt them.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, maybe you, Neil, but no one else, right?
Thank you, and you've been listening to Money Talk, and thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
This is